Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Michael Morris. If you're a regular listener of the show or a regular viewer on YouTube, please do give us your suggestions about how we can change up the Daily Friend Show. We're thinking of reworking the way we do the show, and so we're interested in comments from our regular listeners. Right, let's get into the first news story of today. And this is actually quite an interesting and important topic for South Africa, one that has been very difficult, I think, to deal with. And that is, well, let's start off with some comments made by Constitutional Court Justice Motopo, who was speaking earlier this month at the annual Human Rights Lecture at Stellenbosch University. In a speech titled, A Right to Remain, Spatial Justice and the Transformative Approach to Housing Rights. The justice here was talking about the legacies of apartheid and how this has affected the shape of our cities, saying, quote, few legacies of apartheid remain as visible or visceral as the geography of our cities. Apartheid laws such as the Group Areas Act, Prevention of Illegal Squatting Act, do not merely regulate land use, they engineer distance between black bodies and economic opportunity, between communities and social goods, between personhood and dignity. Just as an aside here, I find there's a sort of terminology in the critical race sort of literature and way of approaching academia where they often refer to black bodies, which I find a really weird dehumanizing term. But anyway, let's not get bogged down too much on that one. So he says the Constitution promised to reverse the spatial separation, but it hasn't really worked. Quote, today, millions still live in the urban periphery, far from work, education, and essential services. In some instances, development itself has reproduced the new forms of exclusion, uprooting vulnerable communities to make way for commercial interests. Basically, he goes on to say that while he believes that cities must indeed evolve, there must be, quote, careful that present-day development does not inadvertently replicate the patterns of exclusion that our constitution was designed to undo. He criticizes various things, one of them being gentrification. That is the idea that you have these neighborhoods that are formerly poor neighborhoods that then sort of get upgraded. They get very expensive, and the opposition to this is that that pushes out the people who already live there because they no longer can afford the rent, and basically their lives get disrupted. The justice here proposes that we should consider something called a right to remain, not as a claim that development should be halted or that occupation rights are absolute, but as a principle that vulnerable communities should not bear the cost of development from which they are excluded. He said, spatial justice requires more than the redistribution of land and resources. It requires the protection of people's existing connections to place, community, and livelihood. For the justice, the transformation of South Africa's urban landscape requires more than the delivery of housing units. It requires a sustained commitment to building communities in which development and inclusion proceed together, in which those who have established homes and livelihoods within the urban space are not lightly displaced from them. So, a lot of stuff, I think, to talk about here about how our cities work. As we know, South Africa's cities do not work particularly well. There has been one study to suggest that something like that South Africa's poorest people spend up to 40% of their money on just getting to work, on transport and getting around. South Africa's public transport system is not particularly effective. In some places, yes, we have buses, and some cities will say, you know, we've got, like Cape Town will say, we've got the MyCity bus and all that, but these are not comprehensive. They're not sort of fully self-sustaining. You know, millions of people still rely on things, for example, like taxis, but even those aren't perfect, and they can be quite expensive. So, Michael, it does worry me a lot when you start saying things like the right to remain, the protection of communities, because those sound very good, and there's obviously a lot to that, right? That, you know, people should be able to, you shouldn't just disrupt people's lives. But this also feels a little bit like a way of sneaking in the belief that, and we've already seen this, that you shouldn't basically be able to evict people at all unless you move them sort of as a group to alternative accommodation, which really seriously undermines property rights because it essentially says that you know, you can't have a piece of property unless anyone who potentially invades it entirely replaced somewhere else. That's essentially what our current legislation ends up creating. And yet at the same time, you know, when you look at these costs that are borne on by ordinary people when they do get moved, the lack of jobs, the lack of resources, I mean, it's difficult to not have sympathy for that point of view as well. How do you look at this whole mess?
It is, yeah. I mean, mess, I think, is a very good word. And it is a very complex one. I've long been very interested in the organism of cities. I covered Cape Town for years as a journalist. So I have always been very interested in how these organisms work, and even how they work when politicians step in and you know, disrupt the sort of natural organic process of them, as apartheid did do. You know, somehow people make their lives kind of work as best they can for them, and that is what produces the geography and the sociology of the city. So a very, very complex thing. That part of the thing that, just as you were talking, I was just, this thought occurred to me, part of my worry, and I'm quite warmly disposed in many ways to the some of the arguments he's making, but part of my worry with the idea of this right to remain as a concept is that it seems to presuppose that certain communities, not must, but will inevitably, in a sense, must inevitably remain vulnerable. There's always going to be huge parts of our society who are going to be vulnerable. And as liberals, we don't accept that. We make the argument that South Africans are people like people anywhere else in the world. There's nothing to stop any of us from exercising our rights and benefiting from that. But for that to work, the property rights is an absolutely anchoring feature of this entire concept of a society that works really well for everybody. And in the absence of property rights, you're going to have massive vulnerability. And so, you know, this is exactly what we're seeing here. We're seeing the very people who have been were deprived of property rights in the past have not benefited from any extension of the property rights in the years since. Instead, the government has tended to focus on expropriation measures to take property away from people without recognizing and others have kept reminding them, by doing that, you are in fact undermining the principle. So they for spent right. 30
it's,
years.
Yeah. It's like looking at South Africa, there's a huge chunk of South Africans, the majority of South Africans that have been denied certain rights, and then saying the only way we can solve this problem is by taking away the rights from those who already do have them, rather than extending the property rights to more people.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a sort of silly thing in a way to say, but you can't take, you know, the existing sum of property rights and spread them around the place and then anticipate that you've actually transformed society in any meaningful sense. So it really does amount to extension. You've got to actually actively find ways to give people a stake in their society or give them an opportunity to drive a stake into it and say, I own this is mine. And in the absence of that, you are going to have this massive vulnerability. It's complicated for a couple of other reasons. I think, you know, our cities don't work well, partly because we have inherited this terribly broken spatial planning from the sort of grave experiment of apartheid, and yet cities provide a much, much better chance for most South Africans than the countryside. And it's for that reason that very sensibly all people are actually much more sensible and rational than we tend to give them credit for. This is why they come to the cities, and they come in their hundreds of thousands. And they will come even if there's no guaranteed accommodation for them, because there is the perception, and they're probably right, that life will be better. They'll certainly have a better chance of a better life, but even life will likely be better, especially if they come to a place like Cape Town. They're likely to get their children into a reasonable school, at least a school that opens and kind of functions properly, and where the circuit inspectors going around and so on. There's a kind of reasonable expectation that if you get to Cape Town, if you can manage to get here from, say, the Eastern Cape, you're likely to have a better life. So it's kind of big picture. About 67% of South Africa is urbanized, so living in the cities. And it's estimated that I think by 2050 is the UNICEF's estimation or calculation, we will be a society that is 80% urbanized. So that means, you know, a hell of a lot of more people living in cities, whether there's place for them to stay or not. And that's where they want to live out their lives and find their fortune and find a better life and so on. And so the problem that we face is not really an abstract one. We've really got to think about what it is that is going to work. And we've argued at the IRR, we keep making this argument, it's got to be based on the fundamental of property rights. You've got to begin with that. But much more clearly is going to need to be done. And it's not a problem for them. It's a problem for everybody. It's a problem for all of us. We all have to contend with this thing. And, you know, my own feeling is simply focusing on law that's going to protect the small number of existing property rights holders without extending that property rights regime as quickly as possible and as sensibly as possible. It's not a question of simply giving things away, but there are various steps that can be taken to expand that, to recognize the kind of property ownership by the extent of time that people have been living in maybe state housing and so on. It's a question also of freeing up state land that is closer to economic nodes in cities, developing incentives for developers to practically consider as an economic proposition mixed use developments or buildings that will incorporate those who perhaps can't afford top rents, but then wouldn't get necessarily the kind of best facilities. You've spoken before, Nicholas, about town planning regulations, which are unduly onerous, make it harder for people to actually provide their own accommodation, and so on. So it's got to be a much cleverer and sort of multifaceted approach to finding solutions to making our cities work.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with this kind of view of things that the is underpinning the justices' thoughts here is this idea that there's these sort of economic core regions, and that's just how it's going to be, and that can't be spread. And what we've seen in South Africa, because of our weak economic position over the last more than decade now, is you've got these sort of enclaves of those who have bunching together to protect what they do have around sort of economic core centers, you know, places like, I don't know, Rosebank or Sandton in Joburg, or, you know, some of the nicer suburbs in Cape Town. And that's, as the economy has struggled on, those have kind of become almost sort of more fortified as everyone packs into there, rather than expanding outwards, which when we did have the high level of economic growth in the sort of mid-2000s, there was a sort of flowing out of wealth to other parts of the country that have been poorer. And I think the idea here is that, well, no, you can't, you know, let's say you can't have people living in, I don't know, let's say Orange Farm, right? South of Joburg. No, Orange Farm is always going to be poor. There can never be any development there. And so if you move people there, it's going to destroy their lives because they won't be able to find work or that kind of thing. And as things stand now, that's probably true. But if you have economic growth, if you have more relaxed town planning, if there's incentives to develop, if you have a workforce that is sort of eager to seize new opportunities because, you know, it's got all these options for making their own way, you'd see businesses maybe not just clustered into small groups kind of in these enclaves. You'd see them springing up in new places. There'd be new jobs outside of, you know, you wouldn't have to travel to Sandton to get a job because there'd be a factory closer to you, or there would be a, you know, some kind of office job in a new office building for a small business that's been built near you. If you expand out the economic opportunity, if you grow the economy, if you create jobs, all these things, that I think also goes a long way to alleviate these problems, because then, you know, it's not so important that you have to live right next to the city center, because there can be multiple city centers, because opportunity is spread, I think, far more widely. And that only comes with wealth, with growth, with diversification, all these things when the economy is allowed to sort of breathe. And so inevitably we're sitting with a situation where, because South Africa has, you know, this sort of stagnant pool of resources because we've had such weak growth, we're just constantly sort of finding ways to slice up what there is. And that's just a loser's game, because somebody has to lose. And if you mess around with those who do have property rights, well, you hurt investment, you weaken all the things that already happen, you violate people's rights. But if you also just ignore those who don't have property rights, then those people become sort of trapped forever in poverty and deprivation. So I think a lot of this is actually just downstream of the general mismanagement of our country's economy and governance, to be honest. So one of the things that makes people cluster in these enclaves is a desire to sort of like pool resources and make sure that there's that streets are cleaned or that there's private security in areas and that kind of thing. When you have a well-functioning government that makes sure that everywhere is clean, that everywhere works well, that the crime is low, that sort of thing, you can have people don't get so tied in, I think, to the area that they're in, because they can start to look at other options. So I don't know, the big topic, but any final thoughts on this one?
I mean, just as you were talking there, you know, I was thinking the two sides of the South African society, if you like, the better off and the poor off, poorly off, share, is probably a sense of defensiveness, of having to defend themselves against threats, and that, yes, is very true. That's very, I think, correct. And it's, you know, and part of that, or a great deal of that defensiveness, if we think in terms of middle class life, with you and I living in Cape Town, we wouldn't dream of not having private security, private medical aid, and so on. You know, we pay for things that are going to protect us against the slings and arrows of life, in a sense. But it's just the same for people who don't have anything. They're also feeling under pressure, constantly at risk. If it's not running out of money, it's somebody wanting to take their money, and so on. And a great deal of that, I think, stems from this quite paternalistic idea, which is present actually in that right to remain idea, is that the state must always be looking for ways to step in and resolve a thing, or step in and prevent.
Right. What did the justice here say? Build communities. That's the job of people, not the state.
Exactly. And I mean, it's not really a leap of faith, but for us in South Africa, maybe it is. Maybe a lot of people who've got this idea that it's got to be a sort of public sector intervention, it's, for them, it's a kind of leap of faith to say, well, let's give the people the chance to choose what they want to do, where they want to live, and so on. And how do you do that? It's not going to happen overnight, but you begin. And we've seen it. You know, we've seen it. I think, to me, the most striking thing is just lifting the years ago in the 90s, or even before then, the kind of rules in place, race law in place, to stop people going to university. The minute you lifted that, I mean, the influx into universities just exploded. And the young people coming out, a lot of them battled because they had very poor schooling and had to be helped and so on, and some didn't do so well. But most of them kind of poured back into the economy and have ever since been expanding the middle class. That is what happens when you let people choose. And, you know, to this day, people in very poor communities, 5 or 6 kilometers where I'm sitting now, have a very clear idea when they get to matric that they've got to do really well, and they'll have classes all weekend, every weekend for the matric, so the parents will be on their backs, poor kids. You've just got to do your very best here, because this is a real chance, and they understand that, and they use it, and that is the thing. But in the absence of, as you were saying, economic growth, investment, fixed capital investment, a figure that our boss, John Endres, is always talking about, concrete in the ground, that's real confident investment long-term. Without those things, the best efforts of South Africans are always going to fall slightly short because there simply isn't the economic churn that provides those that dynamism and that multiplies the choices exponentially. So, yeah, so what, we're seeing quite an interesting snapshot of South Africa's problems in this issue, aren't we?
Yes, yes. And I think it ties into everything else. Like, you know, one of the things mentioned as to why a community might not want to move is schools. But you look at South Africa and you say, well, that's because we don't have that many good low-cost schools in South Africa. You know, there are government schools that you can get into where you either have to pay a relatively low fee or no fee, depending on your finances, that are still are very, you know, high quality. But those are really oversubscribed, and so people don't want to move away from them because it increases transport costs or maybe it undermines the argument for you to be there, that kind of thing. Whereas if we had more good schools in the country, that wouldn't be such a desperate thing for people to have to sort of cling to. The sort of topic is kind of, in a sense, while he's just talking in here about where people live and the design of cities, I do think overall it's really a conversation actually that ties into the bigger problem in South Africa of how we defeat sort of poverty and dislocation and that kind of thing. I do just want to say though that I'm always kind of slightly irritated by objections to gentrification. Like, I do understand the argument, but at the same time, it's sort of this idea that, well, you must just have these communities that must forever remain essentially poor and vulnerable, like you said in the beginning, that there can be no improvement, because if you do anything to improve an area, that will raise the rents or raise the prices, and then everyone will move out. So you're like, no, you must make life better for these people and protect them. But it's almost like treating people like animals in a game reserve, like, oh, they just stay in their nice, pristine environment, you know, because that's where they grew up. And it's like, I don't know, this seems like prioritizing places above people in a sort of strange way. Anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm sure we will return to this topic over the coming weeks, but let's move on to our next one. There has been a bit of an outcry from Ghana when various videos on social media went viral in Ghana that showed a group of South Africans confronting a Ghanaian man over his status in the country and whether he was allowed to be here legally. And various other sort of anti-immigrant and anti-African actions that have been seen in South Africa, the most infamous being, you know, this occasional thing where Operation Dodula members show up at outside hospitals and block people who they believe are not South Africans from going into those facilities. This saw Ghana's foreign minister last week summon South Africa's acting high commissioner to Ghana to convey the government of Ghana's strong condemnation of the continuous xenophobic attacks on Ghanaians and other Africans living in South Africa. So today there was a planned march to the union buildings protesting illegal immigration. And in the lead up to it, President Ramaphosa didn't address it directly, but sort of made some implied comments about it, saying that xenophobia should not be tolerated in South Africa. He said, quote, "We did not walk alone into freedom. These countries opened their borders to our liberation fighters. They shared their bread in their homes. They spoke for us when we could not speak for ourselves. The leaders and people of Africa keep our struggle alive. It cannot be and it must never be that we trample into the dust the African fellowship that made our freedom possible." Well, the protest did go ahead, and it was led by Jacinta Ngubane-Zuma. It wasn't that big. It was only about 150 people, and appears to have not turned violent or anything like that, as some of the fears. I think Action SA was also there. Protesters carried cards that said, "Reclaim our country, stop illegal immigration. Illegal immigration is a crime. GNU, put SA and DF at our borders." Ngubane-Zuma said, "This is not normal migration. I say this all the time. What we are currently facing in South Africa is not normal migration." She said that their movement was not connected to xenophobic attacks. This was falsehoods. "No matter how hard we try to explain ourselves, there's no xenophobia here. We are being we are tired. We just are just creating. They are just creating stories about people who are being hit, who are being killed. Michael, I mean, you know, what's very irritating about, I think, a lot of this debate for you and I in particular is, I think both of us agree, and me perhaps even more strongly, that illegal immigration is not good. We have laws. They need to be enforced. If you have a policy, you know, you can't just sort of pick and choose and just let things go by the wayside. You need to enforce it. Legal immigration does have externalities, like, for example, you know, you don't have a lot of information on people who might be causing crimes. They could, you know, be kind of almost ghosts in the system. It can cause tensions in communities, as we've seen, blah, 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 blah. There's lots of, you know, problems that people can understand. And yet at the same time, there's often this sort of Mott and Bailey argument, as it's called, where a lot of these groups, like Operation Dudula and this group here, when you press them on, is this movement just about hating foreigners? Is it just about chasing Africans away from South Africa? They'll say, no, we just care about illegal foreigners. We just want law and order. We just want peace and quiet. We just want the rules to be followed. But then on the ground, it's, oh, well, you have a funny accent. And maybe you're not even from outside of South Africa. Maybe actually you're from Limpopo. But, you know, we're not going to let you into the hospital now. So what's your take on all of this? I mean, obviously, I think there is a real point here. But there's also sort of a lot going on here that I think has been quite ugly. What's your take on this issue?
I think it's quite a few sort of key points. I'll come back to it, but just to say it before I forget to say it, that I think it's very encouraging that our government has spoken out, both Ramaphosa and Lamola, Minister Lamola, who was he's now Foreign Affairs Minister of International Relations, used to be Justice. Yes. So yeah, I think I might have some kind of sense of the, you know, and he. I was pleased to see him underlining the kind of constitutional element that, you know, of this. It's just not acceptable. So that's very gratifying. Also gratifying that there wasn't, you know, a march of thousands, which would have been ugly. And it's always terribly, terribly distressing, I think, when people are singled out.
When this group recently held a protest in East London, it turned violent and there was clashes with police and stuff, and it got very ugly.
Yeah. So it can, you know, and I always think the bigger a mob, the more mobbish and brutish it is likely to become. It doesn't matter who they are. That's just one of the awful things about being human in a way. We'll come back to the ANC in a minute. But, you know, so I think very good. I'm very happy to acknowledge how important it is that those statements are being made. I think it's quite interesting. I mean, internationally, there appears to be a sort of heightened sense of vulnerability to outsiders or to through risks and, you know, people coming in from outside. A lot of people, I suppose all of us, I don't feel especially stressed, but I think a lot of people, I'm not very active on social media, but, you know, in the immediacy of social media and the modern media, things that are happening 100 kilometers away or 10,000 kilometers away can feel as if they're actually happening to us in our lounge. It's our values that are being attacked, or it's our something that's being reduced or diluted, or whatever the case may be. You have the language of invasion even. I think internationally it's become quite a problem. I can't remember who you were quoting, but referred to this movement is not natural. I didn't quite understand.
That was the leader of the march today saying that the migration, this is not normal migration, she said.
There we go. So, and I immediately thought, well, this is actually very similar to the topic we were speaking about before, but just on a bigger scale. People are only moving because they can and because they think they get to improve their lives. This is it's a human phenomenon. Urbanization has done that, but now it's become, it's kind of internationalized, and that does make it problematic. As you say, there is a difference between people who are, you know, going through the proper channels, making these choices much more rationally and carefully, the society that's being left in the society which is receiving them can at least prepare or have some sense of what kind of sums of money they're going to be needing to be spending on whatever it is, might be healthcare for the next 10 years. You know, it might be doubled or trebled if people are just pouring in. But if that money isn't there, the health service won't be there. And so it does become a problem. It's not something one can just wish away and say, states have just got to provide. It does become difficult if there is no proper record keeping and if it isn't following the kind of certain rules. I don't know whether we have good rules in place. Sometimes when you look at stories every now and then about this kind of immigration and that kind of immigration and
so people funneling. I did once talk to an American who was working here for a while, and she said that she had worked in a number of countries across the world, some of them in Europe, some of them in Asia. And the most onerous, irritating, and obnoxious of all the immigration visa processes to come and work here temporarily was South Africa. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know how
widely
that sentiment is felt, but I think it's probably correct, considering the way our government approaches pretty much all other legislation.
Yeah, so it's very symptomatic of a number of things, and if it's difficult for people at the sort of upper end of the economic scale, which presumably these people would be, you can imagine how impossible it would be lower down. So that it almost invites recalcitrance and intransigence and you know, a kind of bloody-minded indifference to the law, instead of having clear, well-managed processes. Perhaps Leon Schreiber is working on this. I think he seems to be doing quite a good job at Home Affairs, but it's obviously more than one man, one minister can do. But it does seem to be a kind of key area of concern. And the unfortunate thing, of course, is that the consequences of all these things provide a cynical opportunity for cynical politicians to exploit. It's so easy to exploit the difficulties and the problems that arise from kind of uncontrolled immigration, or the perception that immigration is uncontrolled. And it's very easy then for such politicians or movements or people with sort of kind of bad faith actors to generate a narrative that identifies an other, which is or who is to blame for our problems. And I think this is where it's a good point to come all the way back to where I began with acknowledging the importance of the ANC's response, a very good public repudiation of xenophobia. But two things that are linked to that. One is the unfortunate exception in our politics is that our own political language is one in which there are insiders and outsiders. There are those who belong and those who don't really belong. It's whether you the right color. It's all these kinds of things, and so the ANC needs to really focus on aligning all of that and recognizing that there's a problem here. It's talking with a forked tongue. We often hear them talking about our people, and we don't really know whether we're included or not. So that's immediately a problem. And then the other thing is that, the tensions that are arising in society here are tensions not arising from illegal or any kind of immigration, really, but the low economic growth, the joblessness, the desperation, the dysfunction, the corruption, people in high places getting hundreds of millions, some billions even. I mean, I've lost track of how many noughts we have to add on to these sums. corrupt dealings, and they're driving around in Maseratis and cars that I can't even pronounce. And you can imagine how the poor people look at this and think, well, and they're getting away with it. Is anything ever going to get better?
I think that the part of this is also just a general frustration with the general feeling of lawlessness in society.
Yeah,
is that anyone can just do whatever they want, and people are tired of it. Exactly. And illegal immigrants, or legal immigrants even, are a kind of easy target for that. But on a slightly different track, one of the really interesting things about this to me is how you know, the sort of pan-Africanist idea, this idea that black people are a nation in of themselves, race nationalism, as we sometimes call it. And then, you know, as you see it, as you say, often we see it in the ANC and the EFF, this idea that, like, for example, you know, whites are whites or Indians or sometimes even colored people are not real South Africans. You know, they're sort of outsiders, guests, foreigners. It's the kind of thing you see on social media sometimes. And sometimes from politicians, not just from social media.
No, indeed.
When you see these kind of xenophobic attacks, it's actually a reflection of how that view is not really as widespread as you might think from looking at social media or simply how politicians speak. That the sort of race nationalist idea is not one that I think a lot of South Africans or most South Africans buy into. And we see that in our polling, right? When we ask about race relations and that sort of thing. But also when you say, because apparently one of the things that was said in one of these social media videos to Ghanaians was, go home and fix your own country. And there's this kind of actual rejection of Pan-Africanism in a way that I think the ANC and EFF are very upset by. And you can see that in Ramaphosa's comments and also in Malema's comments, because Malema has been speaking out against some of this stuff. But he's not been speaking out against it because it's bad in of itself. And that, you know, divisive rhetoric. He's just been saying, no, we must focus on the common enemy, the white monopoly capital, whatever it is. I think that is interesting how, despite, you know, Pan-Africanism has long roots in South Africa. It's over a century old in many ways. And yet it really hasn't become, I think, really embedded into the DNA of how most ordinary South Africans view the world. And that is something to ponder.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've gone quite long. Let me just very briefly mention, we won't do a full discussion of it, but this it is worth bringing up just out of amusement. Solly Malatsi, the DA Mayor for Communications Department, put out a policy document about South Africa's view of artificial intelligence and how to deal with AI and, you know, what our approach to it should be as government. Now, I haven't read the policy. I don't know anything about it, whether it was good or bad. But what I do know is that News 24 revealed this weekend that AI had been used to write at least parts of it. How do we know? Well, unfortunately, AI hallucinations, as they are called, when AIs make up stuff, in this case, references to particular academic papers, were included in the footnotes of this paper. Which is now seen the minister say that this was an unacceptable lapse and that the policy will be withdrawn and basically rewritten and reconsidered. So very embarrassing to be caught using ChatGPT to write your policy paper. But also kind of, I could not think of a more amusing policy paper to have an AI hallucination in it than the AI policy paper.
And I mean, I'm also just inclined to acknowledge sorry Malatsi's humility here, where he, in his statement saying that he's withdrawing it, he says quite plainly, South Africans deserve better, and long may this kind of example or far may this kind of example spread throughout government, where ministers do really acknowledge and simply say, we've made a mistake and we're going to make it better. Or, we're sorry. South Africa deserves better. We do indeed.
Yeah.
But good for him.
Yeah. This is a topic that we definitely have more to say about, but we don't have time now. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. And we will be back tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.